Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we're taking a look at some recent data out of Microsoft trumpeting its Defender antivirus install figures on Windows. They've got 18% of the market share on Windows 7 and Windows 8, and 50% on Windows 10. For the AV and endpoint security industry, Microsoft has always been the existential threat. We'll speak with Securosis analyst and Disrupt Ops founder Rich Mogul about that in this week's feature interview. In this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by the always entertaining Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary. When we spoke, Haroon had just wrapped up his first ever booth at the RSA conference. He'll join us this week to tell us that, surprisingly, it was a really worthwhile exercise for Thinkst. But as you'll hear, he also thinks the broader industry can be a real pack of dumbasses when it comes to actually marketing tech at events like RSA. If he becomes global ruler, these sort of booths will be gimmick-free and just show people product demos. Comrade, I approve. That one's coming up later, but of course, before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, you know, I think it was a couple of weeks back we spoke about this kid in Canada who'd been arrested for, you know, basically downloading public information from some government website using direct object reference. You know, he probably scripted the downloading. You know, his house got raided. He was arrested for unauthorized use of a computer. And we said at the time that it looked a little bit suspicious. Various elements of the Canadian government were saying, look, there's more at play here. Wait till the full circumstances become known. Yeah, it turns out this kid, by the looks of things, did absolutely nothing wrong and that this was a completely dud report to the police.
Yep, the story does appear to go that, he basically straight up went to the site that provides freedom of information things, signed up, paid his money with his credit card, went to download some documents, realized that there was a document number on the end and incremented through a bunch of them. And that was the, you know, extent of the crime. And then at some point later, particular, you know, state body involved decided, I guess now I'm extrapolating, that they wanted to make it sound worse than it was because they were embarrassed about having not done a particularly good job, and then basically reported him for hacking to the police, and then it all went horribly wrong from there.
Look, I really hope this kid can sue them. I mean, that's really what I'm hoping at the moment, because that's outrageous.
Yeah, it is pretty rubbish. And apparently the judge in question who issued the warrant for his arrest.
Not known for good decisions.
Yeah, apparently had previously kind of overstepped the mark in some cyberbullying related case as well. So yeah, either way, it just doesn't look good for that particular bit of Canada.
Now, funny story, this next one. I remember last week we were speaking about, was it GitHub, realized that they had been accidentally logging passwords to like their Splunk logs or whatever, Apache logs, who knows. And we said, hey, logs can be a good source of information like that. And I think it was like within 24 hours of us publishing last week's episode, Twitter came out and said, hey, everyone, would you mind changing your passwords because we've accidentally been logging them? And, you know, that's a really good proactive step of them to sort of acknowledge this mistake and to encourage people to change their passwords. But oh my God, the bad take alert. This one's been going nuts.
It really has. Hey, it's got such a lot of coverage. Like, oh my God, Twitter got hacked. Everyone must change their password. It's like, well, you know, the amount of things that log your creds, I mean, probably, 60% of the things you've ever logged into probably log your clear text creds somewhere in their debug logs already. So yeah, it did seem a little bit hyped up. And a lot of people, I guess, didn't quite get the context of the message, which is, quote, breaches, unquote, go. This is probably the least worst ever.
I've actually seen people who describe themselves as cyber experts saying, my God, why weren't Twitter hashing passwords? This is crazy. Oh, I know. God. It's like physical cringe hearing that sort of stuff. But, it's the thing is, right? Like, I think if this is a service that now offers two-factor authentication through like authenticator apps and stuff like that, like, I guess our advice wouldn't be so much as change your password as like maybe use two-factor and make it redundant.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the goal you want to have is that your password doesn't buy the attacker anything. Even if they know what it is, then they still shouldn't be able to get access to your stuff because of layered controls.
That's right. And, there's no indication either that anyone actually accessed those logs, but, Yeah. Anyway, well done, Twitter, actually, for coming out and acknowledging that mistake, because I think that's that was the right thing. That was definitely the right call. Now, of course, news that just broke over the last day or so is that the United States is pulling out of the so-called Iran nuclear deal. The reason I'm speaking about this on a security podcast is, you know, Iran has really tooled up in the cybers, and I'm guessing that we could see a few very interesting campaigns shake out of this. Of course, we saw, you know, a failed attempt to blow up an ICS facility in Saudi Arabia, and it's believed that Iran was behind that one. You know, we've got Israel bombing Iran at the moment as well. I mean, all of the components are here for Iran to start doing some pretty crazy stuff on the internet. That's my feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, why wouldn't they, right? I mean, if they, you know, feel they've got the raw end of, well, it's not a deal anymore, raw end of the not deal, then cyber is a great tool for them to kind of strike back. I mean, as we've talked about in the past, you know, technologically advanced places like the US, you know, really do have more to lose. And I imagine they're still feeling kind of bitter about Stuxnet. You know, they've probably got a bone to pick, something to prove. And yeah, I mean, you're right. I think this is going to, have all of the ingredients of a thing that really could turn into, we thought all of the being hacked by China was bad. Like, you know, if this really does fall apart, then, you know, we may see it much worse.
I don't think we'll see ICS attacks against the United States personally, because that would be seen as escalation and there'd probably be a response. But I mean, Israel's already bombing them. So if I'm running a, industrial control systems network in Israel, I'd be pretty worried. Saudi Arabia as well. Kevin Collier, who's a cyber journalist who works for BuzzFeed, I mean, he was tweeting about it earlier and thought, hey, as an interesting hypothetical, what would happen if Iranian hackers started targeting, Donald Trump's interests? That would be interesting. And, you know, that does not meet the threshold for an act of war. So I don't know. Are you listening, Iranian APT crews? Can I give you some ideas on that one?
Yep, go and get the Tallinn manual, read up what NATO considers to be a cyber act of war, and then come in, 93% of that.
Come in under that a little bit. But let's see. I mean, it's probably going to take a few months. Like usually with something like this, if there is an increase in activity, it'll take us a few months to start seeing reports and see what's happening. But yeah, I'm guessing that's going to kick off real soon. A bit of drama over at Facebook. One of their, security analysts got the boot for apparently stalking his Tinder match. Using his access at the company, which is, not real wise and not real good and just bad. No biscuit.
Yeah, really. I mean, that's just super creepy. And obviously, as we centralize all of our lives into this kind of tech stuff, we do need to be mindful that, there are sysadmins and network engineers and security people and all sorts of people who work at companies, who can circumvent the controls put in place. For Facebook's part, they say they have a whole bunch of logging and oversight, and they train their staff, and they have warnings that pop up if you're accessing things through the, regular channels that, suggest that you should probably be doing this per authorization of the policies. But in the end, right, all the data has to live somewhere, and there are people who have access to it, and, people are people, they're jerks, and a portion of them are always going to abuse it. So
yeah, and Motherboard had a decent write-up on the, on the broader issue here, where they spoke to some people who used to work at Facebook and said, well, this isn't the first time. People do get the boot for this. And ultimately, the, security engineers need this type of access and do have pretty substantial access and unfettered access to customer information because, they need to be able to dive into various accounts that might be bot accounts or peddling malware or whatever. So they kind of need that access, but, it does happen. There is this sort of stuff happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's inevitable that abuse will occur, and the key thing is to have systems that can identify that it has and then, an appropriate recourse afterwards.
Bit of research here. This is a lot of fun. Drive-by Rowhammer.
Yeah, this is just such a super cool research. I know we've talked about Rowhammer in the past, and listeners will probably know that I'm a fan of Rowhammer and the kind of cool intersection between hardware and software attacks. Anyway, this is a really good example of taking what we didn't really think was super practical, like doing Rowhammer on Android, in particular the Qualcomm socks inside Android, some Android phones. But this is an example of using the GPU that shares resources like memory with the CPU. GPU to implement row hammering to attack the CPU. So they're using the much more controllable properties of GPU shaders and stuff, which you can access from a web browser via WebGL to then do row hammer style attacks against the RAM and take advantage of the, kind of higher precision timing and a bunch of other things that you need to do row hammering well, and using the GPU to do it to attack the CPU, which is just like super cool work. It only their demos at the moment, I gather, only work on a particular model.
It's all going to be specific to the individual handset, isn't it? Like, this isn't an attack that if you get it working on a Nexus, you'll get it working on a Samsung.
No, I mean, I think in this, obviously it's going to have some tuning per, I guess less the specific phone and more the specific system on chip that it's running. So things that run a particular Qualcomm SoC, in this case, they did it on Nexus 5. So things that share the same actual SoC, plausibly it's transferable. But the work is in general applicable. There's been a bunch of patches go into things like Firefox and Chrome to try and remove some of the tools. But as a general kind of primitive, like using the GPU for this kind of thing is pretty cool. I mean, we talked about, I think Ben Hawkes talked a while ago about the sorts of things you could do with WebGL and the attack surface that it exposed. And this is a great example of what that's bought.
Now, look, we are all familiar with the challenge of running multiple accounts for communication tools and social networks and all of that stuff. So, this app developer came up with this thing called Droop. A very popular Android app that, lets its users sort of unify their contact books and messages and all sorts of stuff. 10 million people use this stuff. And it turns out, they're pushing all of that data into an open S3 bucket. Someone found it and just started live tweeting. I was watching that. It was horrifying. Bad.
Yeah, it really is just complete rubbish. I mean, the vendor in this case is saying, it's only one feature and it's only some limited subset of users. But when you've got lots of, tens of millions, whatever, 10 million users.
Yeah, a subset of that is still a lot of people.
It's still a lot of people, even if it isn't. The guy who was doing this, said there were, quote, billions of pictures in the S3 buckets that people had shared during chats and stuff. So, it's kind of hard to say. It's all gone now. It really doesn't bode well for something that you're centralizing all of your comms into, right?
Yeah, and
I think people have a right to expect kind of better.
Now, look, we've spoken about Drupal getting to a bunch of times and, it is what it is. We're not going to get bogged down in talking about it too much this week. But, people are still getting owned quite a lot with flaws in Drupal. But funnily enough, they're people are dropping crypto miners on Drupal boxes. And I'm just thinking, how much crypto can you actually mine with a compromised Drupal blog? Come on.
The thing that's interesting here is someone hacked, 400 different websites running Drupal, and they're dropping a JavaScript Monero miner on the users, not on the web server itself.
Okay.
So they're actually trying to get, if you go and buy a ticket to the San Diego Zoo, all of a sudden 80% of your CPU is mining Monero.
Let me rephrase. How much cryptocurrency can you actually mine using, JavaScript miners embedded into browsers? Like, same question, right? Didn't we see that research that said someone, dropped miners on hundreds of thousands of people and they made like $7?
I don't know. Like, surely you would think that there is a better way to monetize a bunch of hacked Drupal boxes. But hey, I guess it's easy, right? You do it once and then you just kind of deploy it everywhere and forget about it. And maybe you get $20, maybe you don't. I suppose it's easy, but surely there's a better way.
An interesting report out on, Chinese government espionage activity that hint at attempts to really get into the supply chain there. This looks like a pretty comprehensive report. Can you walk us through it?
Yeah, so there's been this report drop that's been covered by a number of different outlets with different angles, talking about, how a bunch of the different Chinese groups are kind of converging or have converged on using similar infrastructure and similar techniques. One of them obviously is the move towards kind of supply chain centric attacks, but also using shared infrastructure and a bunch of other things that plus some OPSEC failures that really have kind of tied together what used to be quite distinct groups into one sort of, this is Chinese intelligence going about their business group, largely dubbed the Winty Umbrella Group now. Winty was one of the original tools, and Umbrella because it encapsulates a bunch of the groups that were previously kind of separate, but now share enough infrastructure. So there's been a few bits pulled out of the port. One, obviously the tie-up to the move towards this kind of supply chain attacks. I mean, in particular, we talked about Netserang getting owned in South Korea, which was then used to manage a whole bunch of stuff in another bunch of places attributed to this group. So and a bunch of other examples of you know, infrastructure providers, IT providers being targeted, to have, you know, even games companies targeted, to have certificates stolen to sign malware to use, and it's hacking other corporates. So yeah, like all of this kind of supply chainy stuff.
It's nice to see a high level overview of this stuff instead of a write up on one campaign, which is what most InfoSec companies do these days.
Yeah, no, it really, I think, has pulled together a lot of the sort of loose ends and tied them up into one much more unified story, with also a more unified kind of trajectory pointing forwards that we can look at and say, oh, like, here's what's going to happen. So, you know, I think it's been a good, you know, a good kind of week of write-ups around that subject.
More research here. Some company based in Maryland called Sonatype has looked at the install base for like vulnerable struts. And there's a lot of it still out there, which is really depressing. You would have thought after the Equifax thing that, you know, there would be less vulnerable struts out there. Now, they said, okay, the headline figure is there's 10,000 vulnerable sites out there using this old crappy version of struts. What is interesting, though, is that apparently like half the Fortune Global 100 companies are using the vulnerable version of Apache Struts. Now, I can understand if a small business or a medium business might, you know, this might have slipped through the cracks, but come on, man, like a Fortune 100 company, you would expect would be running an updated version.
Yeah, we see, then again, every pen tester and every hacker goes, yeah, you see this everywhere. Like, this is just, like, super, super common. We see, you know, I mean, enterprise Java apps in general, but, I mean, Struts is one common thing. There's a bunch of other Apache, you know, the Spring framework, bunch of other Apache stuff that is just in everything Java. And it's not like people run Struts and that's an application. Struts is just a component, and often it's bundled inside stuff that people have no idea what's inside it, and the vendor is not anyone who patches regularly or often, right? They're all kind of, you know, business software vendors that don't actually have a security process, and so you end up with Struts in everything, and Spring in everything, and, you know, all of the other, you know, Equinox frameworks and things inside all of these apps, and no one has any idea how they actually work, and they're all made of vulnerable rubbish. So I'm not even slight. I mean, I'm, you know, 10,000 seems off by an order of magnitude to me. Probably two.
Yeah, 10,000 that they found in an afternoon when they had nothing else to do, right? I mean, so, yeah. I mean, but anyway, for God's sakes, go investigate, scan, look, get rid of it.
Just do something.
The European Central Bank has proposed a framework for, you know, according to the headline here from Cyberscoop, to strengthen the financial system's defences. It looks like really what they're doing is encouraging some sensible stuff, a lot of it around sort of red teaming and pen testing and whatnot. I think the idea is they're going to encourage or, you know, make these ideas available to regulators in, you know, member countries, and they can decide if they want to make people do it or not. But it looks pretty sensible and will probably be a bit of a boon to pen testers in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see that they are going to fix all of the security problems with the banking system with this great new thing called pen testing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you'd kind of hope that maybe they had been doing before. But, oh, yeah, I guess it's, you know, having the regulator encourage it is really good, because a lot of banks don't necessarily
test
properly.
Yeah. Right?
They test the wrong thing in the wrong scope.
Now they can get their pen tests done and ignore the findings as well, like the bigger banks.
Yes, exactly right. That's certainly a step forward, at the very least a step forward in terms of making sure we've got lots of work in our pipeline. So thanks.
Yes, exactly. Adam gets a new car. Happy days. Oh, some hilarious news from North Korea. Some Checkpoint researchers have taken a look at like North Korea's antivirus software that they run apparently on their Windows boxes. It's called Silly Vaccine. And apparently it's like a straight rip of like a 10-year-old copy of Trend Micro, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, no, this is most hilarious. They appear to have ripped off, as you say, a 10-year-old version of Trend Micro. It looks like they had the source to some of the components, because there's evidence that some bits have been recompiled with different optimization settings. But yeah, it's 10-year-old Trend Micro. They've got a routine that renames all of the Trend Micro virus names so they don't look like Trend Micro ones. Like, it has a translation table to replace, you know, like when it's variant 1 through 5, it replaces them with A through F, and it like changes the case and stuff to make it not look like Trend Micro virus names.
Why would you even try to hide that you've ripped it off? That's the part that I don't get, right? Like, who's going to come and arrest you or sue you when you're in North Korea?
Well, and certainly Trend Micro, for their part, have said, like, we don't think illegal recourse is of any use.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not clear how they got the source. They're using Trend Micro, like, virus definition files. And then one of the interesting bits that came out of this was there's, like, a hard-coded extra bit that they've added, which specifically ignores one signature out of the Trend Micro virus definition files, which presumably is something North Korean that the North Koreans don't want you to know about. Anyway, so yeah, this is one thing they just kind of, you know, like exclude in code. So that's funny. And then there's like a bunch of, there's a bit of a kernel driver where they've clearly just kind of decompiled somebody else's kernel driver with IDA, because there's like IDA constructed subroutine names compiled into debug messages. So they must have decompiled it, recompiled it, and then there's a bunch of bits where it's just plain up broken, like in the kernel drivers and stuff. Anyway, it's complete garbage, as you would expect, and it's ripped off Trend Micro, which is hilarious.
So, it is, yeah. It is very, very funny. Trend Micro also is a Japanese company, so you know, some people might not know that. So, you know, from the same region, and certainly no friend of North Korea, that's for sure. Oh, someone's released some. Is this like a plugin? You can. It's designed to allow people to do end-to-end encrypted messages over Slack, which some people, I'm guessing, will want to use because, you know, Slack allows the boss of, you know, corporate Slack channels to actually read people's private messages. So someone's found a way around that. Is this does this look rubbish or does it look good?
Well, I mean, it's rubbish in the sense that you need it. I mean, it's implemented as a Chrome plugin. I don't know what the code quality is like. It does basically pre-shared key crypto and then just kind of spits into the Slack messages in an encoded form that's then decrypted at the other end. It doesn't do any key management for you, so it's just kind of like Babby's First sort of thing.
Yeah, so you email the key or read it to them over the phone.
I mean, we've seen plenty of overlay crypto systems for messaging. I mean, OTR is the classic one, at least has key management, and you would have been better off implementing OTR over Slack, I would have thought. But hey, I mean, I don't know it's a thing I would advocate that anyone uses, but there are a bunch of people who don't necessarily understand that this is how Slack works. And for that, this kind of publicity is good. So, I mean, it's probably doing more good in that sense than it is in terms of its actual, you know, being the piece of software.
Yeah. We had a Patch Tuesday come and go and 67 security issues, including an IE0 day, according to Bleeping Computer. Was this a bad O day or was this like a something that required about 10 other things to chain together to get it to work?
I think this was a real bug. It was being used in the wild. I mean, it was a real bug. People were using it. It wasn't, an obscure one. Actually, there was a bunch of bugs this month too. And there was there was a flash update as well that they Microsoft packaged and shipped. So it's worth applying just for those. But not that anyone uses Flash anymore.
No,
but still,
I mean, it's you don't see it anymore, you know.
Which is great. But no, just a whole bunch of stuff fixed. Microsoft's new security knowledge base thing is so hard to navigate. You can't even tell what the bugs are for anymore. It's really difficult. So I don't know.
Everyone loves to bitch about it. Okay. You know, it's just like, I may have heard a few people making similar complaints. Now there's these, Dasan GPON routers. This is some like home gateway router. There's bugs in them and there's a million of them out there. And now someone's going and assembling a botnet out of these things. Is that what's happening here?
That does seem to be what is happening here. Yes. For those who don't know, GPON is the gigabit passive optical network standard, which is what, the sorts of fiber networks we're seeing, fiber to the home networks we're seeing rolled out in places like New Zealand and Australia. And those of you who are lucky to have NBN with fiber in Australia, this is what you have. It's GPON. Also used.
Yeah, there's 10 people who have that and they're thrilled.
Yeah, all of them. And plus, I mean, there's a bunch in the US. I mean, it's quite a common technology for doing fiber to the home.
I didn't know that. That's why I was curious. Yeah.
This is the GPON ONTs are the kind of customer premises end of the fiber. In this particular case, one vendor had a web internet facing web interface, and it had straight up command injection in the debug run ping command, like shell meta character injection. So like every customer premises device ever has had that at some point in its history. But yes, the main thing is that these are for fiber connected devices that typically have 100 meg, couple of hundred meg upstream, which would make a hell of a DDoS botnet. A million 100 megabit upstream boxes. Yeah, you could wreck a lot of things with that. So that seems to be what's happening.
Yeah, 1 million fiber connections is going to be pretty damaging.
Yeah, and that's internet ending kind of number of packets. So yeah, someone's turned that into a botnet with, command inject. The exploits have been kicking around. It really is that simple. Web request with your shell command in it, job done kind of thing. So
you wonder how many different ways those devices have been owned, and if there's that, the age-old botnet war thing happening, taking over the device, locking others out, that sort of thing. But yeah, let's see who wound up with them. I'm sure we're going to find out soon. Before we go, Adam, Carbon Black has listed on the NASDAQ, and apparently their stocks closed 26% up on their first day of public trading. So just wanted to say a big old congratulations to those at Carbon Black.
Yes, I hope you enjoy all of your goodwill fortunes, I guess. Fortunes is probably what you get from that. So yes, enjoy your fortunes.
Yes. Beers on you at Vegas, in Vegas this year. All right, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, of course, when I was speaking to Adam about the US decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, I said that Iran is being bombed by Israel. I just want to clarify now that I was speaking specifically about Israel bombing Iranian interests in Syria, not Iran itself. So sorry for not making that clear in the original discussion. Speaking of clarifications, last week I said that Silvio Cesare, our feature guest, was the primary organizer of B-Sides Canberra. It turns out that Silvio is very much a co-organizer with Kylie McDevitt, and I actually knew that, and I just had a brain fade last week, so I just want to apologize to Kylie for that and to correct it. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now, and we are chatting with Rich Mogul. Rich is the CEO of Securosis, an analysis firm, and also a founder of Disrupt Ops, a cloud management platform provider. I first met Rich around 2003 when he was with Gartner, and honestly, he's one of the few industry analysts I've encountered who has a consistent track record of being right. He's a very smart guy. He's been doing this forever, and I wanted to get his take on a blog post Microsoft published back in March. Now, most of it is marketing fluff, but the TLDR is they're claiming Defender has an 18% market share on Windows 7 and 8 and a 50% market share on Windows 10. And if I'm an antivirus company executive, that's enough to make me a little bit sweaty. But funnily enough, Rich doesn't see Microsoft's advances in the AV space as the real threat to the AV and endpoint security industry. He says the real threat is Microsoft's advances in platform security generally. As he points out, you don't see too many people installing antivirus software on iPhones. He joined me for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
Well, you know, I think it's a known issue for a while now that Microsoft is the big kind of the big bad in the antivirus industry. And not just because of what they're doing with Windows Defender, because, I mean, really, it's become very hard to recommend consumers go out and buy antivirus, for example, which has been for a long time some of the mainstay financials for some of these companies. And I think within the antivirus industry, they're aware of it. And I think even within the security industry, we're starting to see, you know, a lot more awareness of that, you know, it doesn't need to be perfect, it's good enough. And you combine that with the latest operating systems, which are significantly harder to breach than previous versions, that the entire kind of market for endpoint protection gets kind of flipped around on its end.
Well, and this is an interesting time for that to happen, given the amount of investor funds that are pouring into the EDR space. And you've got to wonder whether people are buying the EDR to use it as EDR or whether they're just buying it as like AV plus. And if so, you know, what effect is, you know, Microsoft's success here going to have on them?
Well, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. First, the platform matters and operating system version matters here. And if you're not on, you know, Windows 10 and all the latest greatest and you've got all the right widgets turned on, then you are definitely going to be experiencing more issues. So I did an informal survey, you know, kind of just putting it out on Twitter. And this was about 18 months ago when I was doing some research. Hey, those of you who have moved most of your organization or transitioned chunks of your organization onto Windows 10 versus, let's admit it, XP still, or even Windows 7, what have been your infection rates? And they all reported just massive declines in those rates.
Yeah.
That's that part that Microsoft, they're just knocking out that low-hanging fruit, and Windows Defender is effective. Now, the EDR vendors are the reason that, you know, all of those various vendors, the more specialty ones are out there, is for a couple of reasons. One is the more sophisticated and targeted attacks are still definitely an issue. It's much harder on the modern platform. So you don't get hit as much with like the drive-by browser malware, but tricking somebody through a phishing attack to open something up.
Well, I think what I've taken to doing recently is describing antivirus as like an operations tool rather than a security tool. You know, it's a good antivirus is about dropping your refresh rates on desktops and making things run smoother. It's not about knocking out sophisticated attackers.
Well, I think antivirus itself, the traditional way we've thought of it, I mean, that market's just kind of going away. And yeah, that's not really what any of these tools do anymore. That market is definitely going to fade, and it's becoming more into either the EPP and the advanced protection, and then there's all the logging and auditing capabilities that those have that you're not going to get out, the manageability capabilities. So becomes more of a management platform, like you said, an operations and management platform than a pure security one.
Well, and the thing that's got me thinking is Microsoft is continuously also improving like host instrumentation. So I wonder at what point people are still going to need endpoint clients for endpoint security versus just configuring Windows to push the right information to the right places. You know what I mean?
I think it's a time-limited industry. This is not a popular view out there, and we all like to think that there's going to be this advanced thing or that advanced thing that you need. And I've got proof, and my proof is in my hand, and it's this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at what's going on in the iOS world right now, the sandboxing and platform hardening will basically wipe out large chunks of the available market. Now, I'm not saying there's still not going to be a need for advanced tools or different forms.
Yeah, but it's like
the number of
organizations that are going to require them is really going to diminish. And, you know, I hear what you're saying about advances in platform security, but it also seems like the stuff that is left over, they're chipping away at that as well by, you know, improving instrumentation and also baking in some pretty decent anti-malware tech.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we look at that larger ecosystem, so everything from DLP to employee monitoring, you know, there's a lot of different chunks and moving parts around some of those platforms or the firewall pieces. I don't know what the end date is, and there's obviously a very long tail. But, you know, I see this now, and you probably see it yourself. We've always divided things up into the enterprise market and the consumer side. None of these companies are really targeting the consumer side anymore. If anything, the consumer side is being pushed into people's routers. Mm. So Symantec's got their new one. I think that was a great idea. Their version of the Eero and Luma and all of those kind of mesh network appliances with the security baked in, and you charge $100 a year for a subscription, which is what they previously charged for the antivirus. So that's an interesting model, but you know as well as I do, they're just, you know, that part of that market's going to go away. I mean, people with Macs don't run any of that stuff. iOS, you don't run any of that stuff.
I think this is going to take a while, right? Like, it's not like there's there are clouds on the horizon rather than an imminent storm threatening the village.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's that long tail comment from before. We're talking years. I don't know how many years. I think a lot of this, you know, might even be a decade. We are seeing impact in certain areas already. The question is how widespread does that become and how quickly does that move? And in the enterprise market, there's still unmet needs that these third-party tools have come in on. I mean, there's a reason people are buying, you know, I don't know if you want to throw the names or not, because I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
please.
I stay out of, you know, the Cylances and the, you know, even the Bit9 Carbon Blacks and all of those kinds of tools that are out there because for telemetry, for the advanced attacks, for older platforms, or for consistency of management.
Now, that's a big one. That is absolutely a big one, especially in a world where you're going to have a mixed fleet of Windows devices, right? And look, I mean, Microsoft has made some spectacular mistakes in the past when it comes to security technology. I don't know how closely, and I'm guessing you would have been an analyst at the time, the whole Forefront experiment, you know, as far as endpoints go, I actually put on an analyst hat and did a gig with a friend of mine who was had a client that at the time would have been the biggest Forefront like desktop AV install in the world. Like, I'm talking over 100,000 desktops, and he was brought in to have a look at that, and he wrote me in a contract under him to just really sanity check that plan. And we actually wound up having to knock the whole thing on its head, because it turns out the client would have needed to build an entire data center to run all of the Microsoft operations management boxes that would have been required to operate it at that scale. So we knocked it on its head, but, you know, we wound up talking directly to the product team, and they had this roadmap, right? And they're like, within 12 months, this is all going to be SCCM driven. It's going to be scalable. It's going to do this. It's going to do that. That never happened, right? Like, they had the roadmap. It never happened. And then the products just atrophied and died. I'm wondering, I think this time it's different, but that was embarrassing for me, because at the time I was certainly predicting this, like what's happening now. But do you think there's a chance Microsoft could screw this up again?
I never underestimate the ability of somebody to screw something up again. I mean, that could happen. And it's not even that. I mean, it's not Microsoft's goal. Their goal, harden the operating system, make it so it's a more trusted platform. They don't need to get all those nitty-gritty little pieces. And we see a lot of interest in that. For example, as much as, you know, Macs are in much better shape these days, for you know, reasons. I'm not saying that they are materially harder than Microsoft. I think Microsoft actually still has some better protections built into the operating system. But I know plenty of organizations that want to monitor processes on Macs. Yeah. And so they're using tools. They want to be looking for some of those more advanced techniques. And there's enough of a market for that, that I think that we're going to see that. I mean, all the large enterprises and large financials and such, anybody that could be subject to a targeted attack. So the question becomes, to me, this is an economics issue. I mean, the economics of the attack. I think detection rates are always going to matter until we've got those things so hardened that, you know, it's only those higher level. And that's really what it comes to. I was talking with somebody in one of the operating system vendors, you know, years, probably 5-6 years ago. And it was, hey, if we can make it so that it costs $100,000 or more to come up with the kinds of attacks that are required to get onto our platform, that's a win. Like, even if some of the governments can get in still.
Well, I think it was one of the Apple guys, I remember saying something similar, right? Which is like, you know, at the point where people are spending six figures to try to pop shells, like, you've won.
Yeah, exactly. But we can't forget that a lot of the clients that I work with, some of them need to worry about somebody who's willing to spend six or seven figures in an attack because of the financials. And, you know, you look at a large financial institution, some of the large retailers, all these other organizations, that's going to matter. So I also see opportunities for diversification. For example, in retail environments, now more kind of the network gateway monitoring continues to be really important. Monitoring around, I mean, the IoT thing, it's very, very much overblown in the security industry, but there are still real IoT related issues.
Well, it depends who you are, right? If you're running an ICS network or a hospital, it's a big deal. But if you're a traditional enterprise, who cares? Mostly.
Today, but we can't necessarily assume, like, I've got hundreds of IoT devices in my home right now because I've done smart home kinds of things.
Hey, I wanted to ask you as well, like, okay, so say Microsoft is, you know, moves in hard now. And as I say, we're talking about a 50% market penetration in Win 10, right? Which is huge. If the one thing that occurs to me, right, is that Microsoft, if I'm Microsoft, I don't want to inflict too much damage on the wider AV industry because seeing atrophy there will actually kind of upset the ecosystem a little bit. Do you think that Microsoft might on some level want to preserve the status quo a bit?
No, I think Microsoft wants to make a secure operating system.
Yeah. And so you think they'd be totally happy to just blow away, you know, commodity AV providers?
Remember PatchGuard? You know, that was what they tried to do with the original Windows Vista, and they got sued for antitrust for a feature that was just going to make the kernel more secure on Windows operating systems. So, you know, I think, you know, it's the same thing with any of the operating system vendors. And again, reading their minds, not having had a discussion with them, I've actually talked with people at Apple. I've not with Microsoft on the OS side. I think they just want to have a more secure operating system.
So you think the plan really is to make Defender less and less relevant by improving the security of the platform, and then you've got an anti-malware engine to pick up the edge cases.
Yeah, and the reason it takes longer for Microsoft is because they have so many requirements for, you know, unfortunately, they're in a position where they're forced to move slow on a lot of things because of their massive install base and the kind of customers that are on the platform. I mean, Apple got to run nilly-willy for a while where they could just do whatever they wanted because they didn't have those enterprise pressures. And that was something that Steve Jobs, like, he talked about that. So there's no secret.
Well, and they've got less of a driver problem as well, right? Because they control the hardware. So yeah, definitely a lot easier. All right, look, Rich, that's all really interesting stuff. Rich Mogul, thank you very much for joining us on the show to give us your reaction to those market penetration figures. I think you're right. This isn't going to be something that's going to, you know, torch and burn the AV industry just yet. But over time, things are going to get interesting. Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
That was Rich Mogul there. Big thanks to him for that. Also, thanks to James Turner of IBRS here in Australia, because we had a bit of a chat about that too. Thanks, James. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir, the founder of Thinxt Canary. For those of you who aren't familiar, Thinxt Canary is a little hardware honeypot you can plug into your network. It can pretend to be about a zillion different things, and if someone starts messing with it, well, you've got a very high quality signal that you have a problem, that someone's on your network doing lateral movement. I've personally played around with a canary and, you know, I think they're great. Haroon has taken a security product and turned it into the type of thing you buy from Apple. You know, it's in a nice box and the UI is great. And there's all these little touches that kind of add up to the whole experience. They also have a virtual version, like a cloud honeypot version too. That's proving popular. Canary has been somewhat of a runaway success. And they're an unfunded company. They were totally bootstrapped all the way through. And they've been offered VC many, many times, but Haroon doesn't want to go down that path. He looked at the effect VC has on the industry as a whole and basically thought, no thanks. But that doesn't mean he hasn't done some things he never expected to do, like actually run a booth at RSA. Now, he's written an excellent blog post about the experience of running a booth at RSA because it was the first time he'd ever done it this year. It is a fantastic post, and I've linked through to it in this week's show notes. But yeah, the upshot is he found it a valuable experience for his business, but being there and seeing how some other InfoSec software companies actually market their stuff really rustled his jimmies. While he was in California, he also did a talk about the VC thing for the Founders for Founders event that happens around RSA, so we touch on that as well. Anyway, Haroon joined me to talk about all of this, and here's what he had to say.
Like, I've been pretty vocal about trying to figure out the right path between bootstrapping or VCing, and I don't think there's a complete right path. Like, if you're trying to build a Cloudflare, you're not going to bootstrap your way to building all that infrastructure. But one of the things that I want to fight, because I think it's a little bit insidious, is that the industry kind of nudges you towards VC, even if it's not necessarily the best way to go. And I did a lot of thinking about it before this talk. And one of the ways that I think most people get nudged is by messing with your ego. And so, like, I titled the whole talk about you and your ego, because most of the strings that get pulled to convince you to go the VC route actually makes you feel bad for not going the VC route. And look, for the most part...
Yeah, so is it along the lines of, hey, you've got something great here, you should really take it to the world, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of that. So mainly I highlight, like I think, three things. And so one of them is... All VCs will tell you, look, not every business needs to be a VC business. Perfectly fine to find businesses that are not. But then they say these little things that make you feel like less of a businessman or almost make you feel like you're unambitious because you don't want to be their dog in this multiple dog swinging for the fences kind of race. And I think it's important for people to realize that there's a super mixed incentive there. And it's something that people say often, but really needs to be understood. And that's that VCs invest in exits, not companies.
Well, actually, used to be true, Haroon. But, you know, we had a interesting chat with Kelly Shortridge recently where she said that, you know, VCs are increasingly taking their money on the way in, not the way out, which could explain why cybersecurity startups are so, like, ridiculously overfunded at the moment and why anything with even, you know, anyone with even half an idea is getting all of a sudden, you know, a $20 million Series A, right?
Is getting super funded. Yeah, it is interesting. And there's an interesting shift. Look, I think the whole VC world is currently going nuts. I think as we speak, Telegram just raised a basquillion in a completely ridiculous way. But one of the things that's interesting here, and during the talk, I paste this snippet from a recent podcast, Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders, that comes through from Stanford. So it's a super, super well-respected podcast. And they had this founder, Yuri Kim, this VC, speaking about the attributes of great founders. And so she says you need to sell and you need to be a visionary. And then she literally bundles with visionary saying, like, look, if your business is going to go and raise, make $50 million, that's good for you, but that's not what makes me successful. And if that's what you're aiming for, like just a $50 million business, then that's not for us. And then you shouldn't call yourself a visionary, in effect. And despite the fact that it's super airy-fairy, almost everyone thinks that they've got a vision for building the company. And so Silicon Valley has kind of tied visionary with going the funded company route. And I think that's stupid. And then the other thing that VCs promise you is media coverage. And again,
Well, I can tell you straight up how ridiculous that is, because it's the same thing that PR companies do to their clients is they promise them coverage. And, you know, not all coverage is equal and they don't have the access that they say they do. I promise you.
Well, look, for us, we almost believed it, right? Because I'm not sure if you remember, but when we launched, I wrote to a whole bunch of reporters like TechCrunch, Ars, and all of the guys. And I followed all the rules that all the documents tell you how to do it. So
but
like,
I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop you right here, Haroon, because I can tell you as an InfoSec journalist of 17 years experience, company makes interesting product is not news. Okay? Like, we don't care. You want to get the word out about that, please contact the sales department. Don't get in touch with me. It's not news.
Well, what's super interesting is, so I got back the blank responses, except a month later, a funded company, was funded by one of the big incubators, and people ran that story. And people ran that story because of their PR firm. And so I have some of these reporters on my Twitter, so I DM'd them saying, hey, listen, I pitched you almost exactly the same story. And one of them, I've got the tweet for posterity, replies to say, well, who funds you? Those people were funded by YC. Who backs you?
I definitely take your point, because at that point, like, a company getting funded tends to suggest to a journalist who's considering writing about this that, hey, here is a technology with a future. Here is a technology that's going to go somewhere. And that might be a faulty assumption. So I definitely take your point.
And that's what's so interesting is it definitely stung me at the time. But in the fullness of time, those other companies haven't done anything. Like they're struggling to get traction with people who'd actually pay their money. And we're doing pretty fine. So
well, you're doing well on the media front as well. And I think, Haroon, the other thing is, once a company, especially a bootstrapped company, starts achieving some success and journalists hear about it, then they're going to write about it, right? But like, when you're fresh out of the gate, like it's that's just free publicity, and that's not what journalists are in the business of doing.
Yeah, and so my point is that stings in the short term, but that publicity that you're not getting because you're not backed by Sequoia or something like that isn't actually worth that much.
No,
like,
it's not.
Like,
I agree.
Put your head
I
down,
agree.
Pull the product, and actually that'll serve you better. And the other thing that I mentioned is like VCs normally will promise you all of this networking. Okay, and lots of them do come with deep, deep contacts. Again, purely from our experience, early on, I had a VC trying to convince us to sell to another one of these funded companies. And literally, the VC sat down with me and said, listen, as soon as we're out of the gate, we're going to have all our portfolio companies use product B, and they're not going to use you, so you're better off joining us. And at that point, two things were clear. One was that I absolutely wasn't joining them. And the other was I clearly hated that person a lot. But what's interesting is while I was terrified of it in the short term, in the long term, it, like at this point, it's not only not true, it's ridiculous. Like we certainly have some of their portfolio companies as our customers, and no VC is going to go up to that guy and tell him to replace us. Because they won't.
Well, this dovetails this dovetails with the next thing that I want to talk about here. But just as an aside, I know of a major like global antivirus company that sponsored a Victorian Australian football rules team, you know, an AFL team. And, you know, the boards of those clubs are very much enmeshed with, you know, large businesses. They will be directors of the football club and directors on the board of a bank, for example. And I know that after they sponsored this football team, the board members of that football club sent the word down the line that those companies were to use this antivirus software. And those sorts of deals that, you know, when companies aren't winning business based on merits are bullshit. I 100% agree, and it's no reason to do business with a VC. But as I mentioned, this does dovetail well with the second part of this discussion, which is you just went to RSA, right? And you know, you wrote a fantastic blog piece about it, about how you spent roughly about $50,000 just to get your basic booth, fly people in there, staff it, you know, get everything that you needed to actually do the conference. And you actually found it a worthwhile experience. But, you know, as I say, we were talking earlier and you said, well, look, the reason it was a worthwhile experience for you is because you'd already done the groundwork. You had a product that you knew people wanted to buy. And, you know, just because you have a product doesn't mean you should go to RSA or advertise on a podcast like Risky Business, which is what made that conversation earlier a little bit interesting for me.
Yeah. Look, so lots of young companies approached us even before the blog post, kind of the same way I did last year with like a, hey, is this thing worth it? Hey, are you getting value? So I was giving a fair amount of thought to like what honest advice would I give to company X? And you certainly see a bunch of guys who come up there with, look, we've got this super cool thing. We're doing this super advanced thing. Blog post or RSA worked for you. Should we show up next year? And you kind of go like, yeah, it's possible that it might work for you. But there's a bunch of things you want to kind of try to get right before you show up here. One of the big things for us at RSA, I think, so in the post, I talk a little bit about how you can't really choose where your booth ends up being because RSA is just about printing money.
Yeah, so, it's like your first year, you wind up like near the toilets down the back corner, and then they hit you with the renewal form where you get a better selection for your booth for the next year, and that's how they keep you in there, right?
Exactly. But what's interesting is if you go to what should be some super hotspots, and I didn't put this in the post, and I didn't talk about it because I didn't want to embarrass some people, but I took some photographs of booths that are like dead center of the South Hall. And literally, they've got sales guys standing around entertaining each other and killing flies. Because if you've got junk and if you've not made a good showing of it, it doesn't matter where they put you, people are just not going to stop by.
You can burn all of the venture capital in the world on a shiny booth, and it doesn't mean if your products aren't good, I think is what you're saying, right? Like, that's another way to say it. And Haroon, like, I often get asked, you know, I mean, I don't really cover sales for sponsorships in the podcast anymore, but I, you know, sometimes I get roped into a sales call or whatever for Risky Business, and people say, well, how many leads am I going to get out of this? And I'm like, well, that really depends on the market need for your product and whether or not people think it's good. Do you know what I mean? So I can't guarantee that you're going to do $1 million worth of business by sponsoring a Risky Business episode. But you know what? If your thing is what people want, then, you know, you're going to do nicely out of it. And if you don't, you need to go and have a bit of a think about things. That's always my advice.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And look, in terms of RSA, I think there are some ways that people can stack the deck in their favor. Like I touch on it briefly in the blog post, but in some ways we were just recipients of other people playing badly. Like we had a bunch of people who came by and just said something like, you know, man, that's refreshing. Like, it's cool to see just an honest demo. And like at a point you go like, what the hell are the other people doing? Like why isn't demoing your product the default at an expo showing product?
Man, I've been to RSA once, and I remember walking past a booth, and there was literally a dude dressed like a doctor with one of those like mirrors, like mirror headbands, like strapped to his head, wearing a white coat, doing some shit. And I'm like, I just sort of suppressed my laughter and kept moving. You know what I mean? I'm just like, I have no interest in your products because like you're doing a dog and pony show. I don't give a shit. See you later.
There's so many people doing that. I was genuinely shocked. So there's a bunch of people, and now that I know the booth prices, like you can't help but look at a booth and say, okay, this is at least $150,000. And then you say, like, you took your $150,000 opportunity and chose to use it on a gimmick. Like you built a house of mirrors to show people that people can be deceived, or you built a fake rain station to show people that rain ruins your day. Like how bad is your product for you to have to try to sell it based on weather patterns?
You do realize that you sound a little bit like a grumpy old man yelling at marketroids to get off your lawn. You do realize that though, right, Haroon?
Yeah.
Fun. We don't want any fun. We want product demonstrations. Prove your value. No gimmicks.
I'm okay with gimmicks and I'm okay with give people free coffee or give them popcorn. But I do think there's got to be a show of value. And I had this discussion with a few people, and people will always tell me that, look, you're lucky because your product demos well. And I know we are. Like, the product does demo well, and so we have a high rate of closing with it. But I struggle to think of a single product that can't show me a demo that's awesome. Like if you've got a web,
there's always, and this is what I always say, right? There's always someone, like all of these technologies that, you know, that we feature and showcase on this show, right? Like the way that I look at it is it's solving a problem for someone out there, right? So, you know, it might be something where 90% of people listening are like, man, I got no use for that, whatever, you know, whatsoever, you know, click through to the next one. And someone else is sitting there going, oh, thank heavens. You know what I mean? Like this is solving this pressing need for me, right?
Exactly. But even the guys who are selling it are not showing that solution and how it solves that problem.
No, instead, they're dressed as doctors or like as lobsters because there's some lobster cyber tie-in thing that day, or they happen to be giving away lobster canapes or something.
Yeah, and the whole thing just seems it seems inefficient. It seems stupid. And one of the things, like I slightly touched on, one of the things that I'm worried about is that this becomes a general dumbing down. Because if 90% of the people you see are doctors in fake doctor uniforms, then smart people are not going to go onto the floor anymore. Like, you're only going to get people who are entertained by doctors. And much of InfoSec's problem is this market for lemons where bad products drive out good products because people can't tell the difference. And it would be a shame if this completely goes that way too. Like right now, we show up and we largely benefit because we get all of the thinking people actually relieved to not see stupidity. But it would be a shame if it carries on in that trend. And then people just show up expecting stupid things. And then you just get stupid. Like, it's a whole downward elevator.
So I guess the TLDR is, don't take funding because the incentives there are weird. Make sure that you're communicating your product in as simple terms and just do your jobs, people. I think that's what you're trying to say, Arun.
Yeah. So I'm not anti-funding, but think, well, the message is almost the same. There's two core messages. The one is, think hard about why you're doing something. So don't do RSA because everyone is. Don't do VC because everyone is. Like see when it fills your needs and then do it. And then just my overwhelming thing, almost for the industry, for competitors, is just to care more. Like just to try harder.
Okay. I dig it. Last question, because we're over time. Last question. Sure. Are you going to go back to RSA next year and have a booth?
Yeah, we'll be back.
Ha 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 ha. I wish I could get a time machine and just like go back, not even that far, like just take this audio back about 5 years and play you audio of you saying that you just had a positive experience running a booth at RSA and you're going to do it again next year. And I would love to see your face. I think if anyone out there has invented a time machine, I think this is a worthy use. Harun Mia, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about the security business, I think is what we just spoke about, the business of security. Cheers, mate.
Always cool. Bye.
That was Harun Mir there with a chat about venture capital, the RSA conference, and a bunch of other stuff. And honestly, if you aren't familiar with Think's Canary, get familiar. It is a great product. And yeah, you can get a non-gimmicky demo from Think's on Canary as well. Yay! And that is it for this week's show. I've got a great feature interview coming up next week on Hacking PUBG, the game. That's with Marissa Emerson, and it's really, really interesting stuff. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.